Next Thursday, England will play in their first World Cup semi-final for 27 years, taking on either Australia or India at Edgbaston. After that thumping defeat at the hands of Australia at Lord's just over a week ago, a few of us may have had our doubts, but Owen Morgan's side have come good when it mattered, following up Sunday's win over India with a comprehensive, Johnny Bairstow-inspired 119-run victory over New Zealand in Durham. New Zealand will almost certainly join England in the last four, barring a Pakistan win of absolutely epic proportions against Bangladesh on Friday. But if they do go through, it'll be with a whimper, the Kiwis' strong early form in the tournament deserting them. Welcome to the Wisden Cricket Daily Podcast, in partnership with Travel Bag, creating holidays packed full of memories since 1979. I'm your host, Joe Harmon. Later, we'll be hearing the thoughts of New Zealand journalist Andrew Alderson, but first, I'm joined by Ben Jones of CricViz. Ben, you told me yesterday you'd either be in a brilliant mood or a terrible one. I'm guessing you're pretty chipper after that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a more kind of exhausted relief.
Yeah.
I spent the last 4 years building up to this day without really knowing that I was building up to it. But but yeah, I feel very calm now. It would have been an injustice, really, if England hadn't got to the semi-finals. Not because they particularly deserve it within this tournament. They've been stop-start, they've not been brilliant. But for the last 4 years, they've been the best ODI side in the world, certainly in the top four. And it would have been a real shame if during a home World Cup they hadn't made it to the last four.
It would have been a hard one to stomach and a long 4 years to wait for the next
just
one.
Just so much staring into the mirror, just like, can we ever do anything in white ball cricket? I'm relieved. I'm calm. It's the calm after the storm.
Until next Thursday, and then it all starts again. Anyway, on today's match, what was your moment of the day?
My moment of the day was the catch that Jos Buttler pulled off to dismiss Martin Guptill.
Yeah.
Jofra Archer digs it in short on a pitch that's not really given much to that kind of delivery. It's been quite slow. It's been a bit kind of stodgy bounce. And for some reason, this one just gets up and Guptill's too far across the offside and knocks it down leg. And you think it's going to go away for four because Butler's not been in the best form with the gloves. But then he manages to kind of time everything very balletically and all of his alignments work. Everything kind of falls into place and he manages to, at full reach, just get a glove to the chance and takes it and gets up and celebrates appropriately, and Bairstow comes in and rubs his head and kind of the full wicketkeeper's union stuff. And it was just a really nice moment for Butler, because he started the summer really, really poorly with the gloves. And
quite a lot of people saying Bairstow should be keeping across the board.
I mean to do my thing, statistically there's very little difference between them in terms of the impact that they have. It doesn't really matter. Bairstow is a slightly better ground fielder, or outfielder rather, so it's kind of
although
worth
that. Butler's clearly no mug, is he?
That's the point. Bairstow is probably a slightly better keeper, but he's a significantly better fielder, so it's worth having him out there. But it was just a nice moment to see that Butler, who's had a mixed time with the bat during the tournament, he obviously got the ton against Pakistan, but he's not really come off. It was nice to see him get a moment where he could be like, oh yes, I've contributed something really emphatically skillful and beautiful, as Jos generally does, but hasn't done so far.
There is still time for that, of course. It was also not just a brilliant piece of keeping, but also a potentially decisive moment in the game. It kind of felt, I think McCullum and Ian Smith had both said on commentary, if New Zealand were going to chase down that kind of total 300 plus, then Guptill had to really come off because of the kind of the nature of their rest of their batting order. So Guptill to go early and in that manner was a real kind of hammer blow to New Zealand, it felt like at the time.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because obviously New Zealand's best player is Kane Williamson, and he can do pretty much anything, but he can't really do kind of run a ball 140s in Big Ten. That's not really his style.
He also can't really afford to, because he can't take the risk to allow him to do that, because the other players around him aren't doing their jobs.
Exactly, so you need other players to come in and play those high-risk innings, but Guptill is probably the guy who you think, a bit like how Butler is for England generally, that you kind of just think anything is possible as long as they're there. If they come off, they could do anything in any number of balls, and it's the ceiling on what the team can achieve is raised significantly by their presence. It's funny that McCullum was the one saying that, because at the last World Cup you had McCullum and Guptill doing that, and that meant that they were a significantly better side, because you had that ridiculous anchoring middle order of Taylor and Williamson, but actually you had that firecracker opening partnership, which meant that you felt like New Zealand could come out and charge at the blocks and chase anything, but they could also completely take all risk out of chasing 270, which is kind of the skill that you need to win all sorts of ODI games. And yeah, it was a shame that Guptill didn't come off today, just because we were robbed of a spectacle, but it was a beautiful moment for Butler, and obviously a very influential moment in the game.
So talking of New Zealand's top order, that's where my moment of the day comes from as well. Henry Nicholls is first ball in your second innings of the tournament. Gets trapped, LBW, in theory, finger goes straight up from the umpire off Chris Wokes. He has a kind of brief consultation with Guptill and then wanders off. And I think everyone thought at the time, it's a bit high, at least high enough to have a look at. Certainly that was Atherton's reaction in the commentary box. And yeah, sure enough, as he doesn't call for review, but as the replay shows, it was missing the stumps, wasn't even clipping the bail, so it would have been overturned. And it just struck me as well that they were talking in the commentary box about showing a lack of confidence from Henry Nicholls, that he didn't necessarily think his wicket was valuable enough to use the review on. But I think more specifically than that, I think he was thinking, can I use potentially Kane Williamson's review? Kane Williamson is so important to them. I think they said he's scored 32% of their runs in the World Cup before today. And I think in the back of his mind, thinking, well, if I call for this one and I don't get it right, and then Williamson gets one potentially next ball, I've basically blown the match for us. So he just kind of wanders off and takes it.
It's a strange way of thinking, isn't it? Because it almost lulls you into thinking that a referral or a review is a life for a batsman. It's not.
Yeah.
You still have to not get out. You can't just be like, well, I was plumb, but I've reviewed it and I'm fine. So it is strange. I think there's a lot. We're still relatively in the early stages of batsmen understanding how reviews work and kind of the logic and
probably the cricket as well.
Exactly, and probably the mathematics behind it as well, whether it's worth reviewing ever, like certain kind of like caught behinds where you can't have the review retained and stuff like that. But I did think at the time when he was struck, it did look high, and I celebrated, as I'm prone to do rather emphatically, but I celebrated the not reviewing of it a lot more than I celebrated it being given out.
Well, I thought even Wokes' celebration, I thought, was kind of muted to a certain extent.
Yeah.
He was thinking, well, we might not necessarily get this, but Nicholls did the work for him and wandered off.
It was a little bit odd and a bit of a shame, because obviously what we're saying here is that one of the openers was dismissed by a really lovely bit of skill.
Yeah.
And one of them was dismissed, well, wasn't,
or
dismissed.
Wasn't dismissed.
And so that's a bit of a shame, because yeah, it was today was all set up for a really cracking game, and it kind of fizzled out because of those two dismissals quite early.
Yeah, I thought England bowled really well up top. I thought Chris Wokes was excellent again, as he was against India and actually against Australia, which kind of forgotten in the midst of it. I thought he was really good first up, maybe not quite so much in the latter overs.
He's the power play one king, isn't he? Because you've basically got him. I think Trent Bolt is the only bowler to take more wickets than him in the first 10 since the last World Cup, and that goes under the radar a little bit because he's obviously not the most, you know, he's not the most outrageous character. He's fairly chilled. He's not the most outrageous cricketer in terms of his style, and so we kind of ignore him, Wokes, really, generally, until he takes, you know, 12 for at Lord's for no runs in a Test match, and then we all remember how good he is. But that isn't a new thing. Wokes bowling brilliantly with the new ball, and he's really underpinning this campaign. I thought England have been brilliant with the ball, the seamers particularly. The spinners have been a bit mixed, to put it nicely, really.
Yeah.
But actually Wokes has led from the front and given England good starts in basically every game.
Yeah, I think there was a few people thinking when Archer arrived, where does Wokes stand? But I think he's shown us all just how important he is to this England side, and he does something different to the rest of them and impacts in a different way to the rest of them as well.
Yeah, I mean, they're still trying to find the balance, aren't they? They're still trying to work it out as to who drops out, because Archer needs to play and Wood's playing so well, so he's almost undroppable. And I think really England probably want to drop Mark Wood because of the role that he fulfills in the side is similar to Plunkett, but not quite as good as with the batting.
And Archer's got the raw pace.
And Archer's got, so you kind of, he's not really necessary in terms of his role, but he's just been incredible statistically, and he's putting out these incredible numbers, and he's a great presence to have around the side, and everyone seems to really like having him around. And so in a way they've almost been forced into dropping Moeen, who I don't think they wanted to drop really. They do like having two spinners. I mean, they bowled Root a lot today.
Yeah.
As soon as the wickets started to fall. Yeah, so Archer's presence and his emergence has caused a few problems, but they're good problems, aren't they?
Absolutely.
You've got to try problems. And squeeze in this excellent bowler.
Would kill for these.
Exactly.
We haven't spoken about the hero of the day yet. Johnny Bairstow, third century on the bounce versus New Zealand, second consecutive 100 in the World Cup. I feel like we should be searching for a negative to further fuel his run spree and that fire in his belly, as Owen Morgan described after India. But when he bats like that, it's very hard to pick any negatives at all.
I thought the left side of his beard was a little bit unkempt. I thought that he hadn't
see the headlines.
He hadn't fastened his glove correctly.
Slams Johnny Beard.
No, he's in incredible form. He's a ridiculous player, Bairstow, isn't he? Because he does seem to do everything against someone. He doesn't seem to do anything for himself. Everything seems to be kind of to prove a point or to kind of go out and prove someone wrong. He's an angry player, but he's just so relentlessly good. He doesn't play like inconsistently. He doesn't play like a kind of firebrand. He's just relentlessly churning out runs. He's starting to get to the point. He's nowhere near on the same level as a player, but he's getting to that point in the Rohit Sharma is where you're almost surprised when he doesn't make a century.
Absolutely.
And that's a hell of a thing to have in a lineup which is full of brilliant batsmen who make tons all the time, but actually Bairstow's the one who you're like, oh, he's nicked off. That's weird. Whereas Root goes out and gets 80s and Roy either gets 20 or 150. It's Bairstow's the one who you think, yeah, he's the most reliable one. I think that was why a lot of us were quite shocked with the Sri Lanka performance, was he was the one, okay, he's gonna see England home here. But it's almost like that failure has just seen him double down, and now he's gone two centuries in two games, and he looks unstoppable. I mean, would you bet against him making three in a row?
Definitely.
If he can get to the final, he's going to get four in a row? You'd probably bank on it at the moment. He's seeing the ball like a beach ball.
And him and Roy as well, I mean, they got England off to another absolute flyer today, which I thought they did the contrast of the first kind of six or seven overs, which just showed that they're playing different cricket here. And I wonder if there's a kind of a competitive spirit between Roy and Bairstow as well, in a sense that they're both very much team players and don't play for landmarks, but they also see one player shot, the other player's a shot. They both got to 50 within kind of two or three balls of each other today. They seem to perfectly complement each other. And Bairstow, there was reference to kind of Bairstow's patchy form early in the tournament. I mean, he got a couple of very early dismissals, which, I mean, if you get dismissed that early, can you even be in bad form? Especially to me, he's looked in fantastic form throughout the tournament, and now we're just seeing him get the scores to kind of back that up.
They're a really funny pair, Roy and Bairstow, aren't they? Because they average more than every other opening partnership in history that have played 20 times together in ODI cricket. They are the best ODI opening partnership ever in that regard, and that is mad. But we also slightly overestimate how good Hales and Roy were. We think that they were absolutely relentless. They weren't. I think they've got the third worst opening partnership for England on average. One of them would always go on and do well, but as an actual pair, they weren't very.
That's interesting.
They weren't very effective. They were obviously two brilliant players in good form, but they weren't quite the same match as these two are. Whereas Roy and Bairstow, they just seem to complement each other. And I don't think it's any coincidence that England's revival and kind of clarity of thought and strategy has come off the back of those two being reunited. When it was Vince and Bairstow, England was struggling. I mean, against Afghanistan, they got away with it because of Morgan. But generally, it's that's hinged to the performance. And those two coming back together has really kind of just kick-started. Ah, yes, England are actually very good at ODI cricket.
That's felt like a decisive factor over the last week or so, hasn't it?
Which is why Bairstow diving to try and save three when the game is absolutely won, it just feels absolutely reckless. It's like Archer doing anything other than running into ball.
Well, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But don't do it again, Johnny.
So there was a few grumbles as England's brilliant start fell away today, and they really struggled in those kind of latter middle overs and then had a little flurry at the end to get over 300. Ben Stokes, I think 11 from 27 balls today, kind of did a donny. But there does seem to be a trend developing in the recent part of this tournament where teams are getting good starts or excellent starts in the case of today. And then falling away and not getting the 350 that they seem to be set for. I wondered if this does have something to do with the pitches, and I noticed this thing today, the CricViz pitch pace rating, which is actually new to me. So the stat I saw was it was the pitch pace rating was 8.4 in the first power play of England's innings and 3 for the third power play. Can you explain how that's calculated and exactly what it means and what it's showing us?
No, it's really cool. Basically, we take all the career data for the bowlers that are playing in the match and all the ground data for the ball tracking data, the Hawkeye stuff, DRS, all that kind of data, how fast they bowl, how much seam they get, all of these kind of components of their bowling, and through a very complicated mathematical thing that I don't quite understand, we compare it to what they're getting on any given day, and then you basically get an average. You can basically assess the effect that the pitch is having on their bowling, and then that comes out as a series of numbers that compare how the bounce of the pitch, the deviation, so how much spin they're getting, how much seam they're getting, and the pace. And the pace is kind of the pace off the wicket, so how much the ball is decelerating after it pitches, which is obviously what you're talking about when you think about the ball sticking in the pitch, or tennis ball bounce, or if it's kissing the surface. All of those kind of things are about the speed that the ball is coming off the pitch. And today we saw that in the first 10 overs, like you say, 8.4 is very high. That's a very high pace rating, and the ball was coming really onto the bat, and everyone was going, "Oh, it's a road! It's an absolute road!" Yeah. Bairstow and Roy, they're both going to get doubles. England going to get a million, and New Zealand are probably going to chase it down. But then, as the middle overs come in, it drops. I think in the middle overs it dropped to 3.4. I should know. I wrote about it about 10 minutes ago. But it kept on dropping, and then it stayed low for the New Zealand innings as well. Basically, the pitch slowed up. I don't know quite why. It's not an exact science, pitch deterioration, but basically the pitch got slower and harder to time your strokes on. And as a result, no batting lineup could really have matched what England did at the start of the day, because the ball wasn't coming on. They weren't playing effectively on the same wicket. They essentially played two different games, which is why, in some ways, the argument that, oh, Bairstow and Roy only do it on flat pitches, obviously, inherently, it's fatuous, it's silly. They've done it in so many different conditions. But today, it was actually true. They did get the best of the conditions, and they nailed it, and they made it count. And that's, in a way, lucky, but it also shows the class of them, that given this little window where they had good opportunities to score, they did. They scored 123 in 18 overs, and it won England the game.
And how quickly they can assess the conditions and work out what they should be on at 10 overs, I think that's a very impressive part of their partnership as well.
I think there's a lot of guys in the England coaching staff that are very good at reading pitches, because as much as we talk about England, you know, struggling on slow wickets, stodgy wickets, they rarely go out and try and actually get 400 on those wickets. They know that they need to adapt. It's just that they haven't always got the skills to adapt. And that's fine. You know, teams have, no one ever really criticises slow scoring teams for not being able to make 400 on flat decks. It never works the other way around. But you're right, the actual ability to read a surface and kind of understand what you need to do to judge par before you've made it is a really important skill, because it means that England can know, actually, no, we don't need to get 350 today.
Yeah,
they could have tried to accelerate when Stokes was getting 11 off 20 or whatever it was. They could have tried to carry on going and Stokes skies it on 2 and then Morgan skies it earlier, but actually they knew that if they just stayed calm and progressed through the innings in the same way that they did against South Africa and in the same way that they did against India, they realised that actually 320 is going to be a match winning score here.
So the reduction in the pitch pace rating that we saw today, is that reflective of a trend over the past few games, and does it mean that winning the toss and batting first is going to be absolutely huge come the semi-finals?
I'm not entirely sure on the first point. I think it was definitely the point with the England India game at Edgbaston. So
that's the one I was thinking of. Yeah, so
you could see
reflecting
that
this.
That could be a pattern that we would look to see. But you know, different pitches on the same square behave very, very differently. We saw that the was it New Zealand Pakistan game, was that at Edgbaston, and the ball, and was that where Santner just absolutely ragged it? Or there was a game at Edgbaston where we saw the pitch just spin ridiculously, and it was terrifying. And then obviously we rocked up and Kuldeep and Jahal goes for his most expensive spell ever, and actually it didn't really spin that much. So it's sometimes a bit over the top to read too much into just the fact that it's in the same 20 meters. Pitches aren't an exact science; they behave weirdly.
Sure,
but like you say, that there is, the sun's out. It's changing. It's getting throughout the day. It's getting hotter. The pitch is getting drier. That does change the way that the surfaces are playing.
And the toss, so how impactful is the toss?
I don't know. I mean today it was obviously massively impactful because it meant that England got that 20 over head start. But I don't know if that's going to be the case everywhere. There's no reason why, you know, that deterioration could happen a couple of hours earlier if the sun's hotter any particular day, or it's damper, or whatever. All those kind of vague components that are in the air could mean that it just deteriorates before play starts, and then it's just difficult to bat on all day at Manchester or Birmingham. We don't know. I mean,
taking the science out of it, though, it looks like England are much more comfortable setting a target than chasing a target.
I think England look way more comfortable being able to pause whilst aiming to get 350 and then go, we're going to get 310. That's fine. But if they're chasing 320, that's when they panic. It's when they're, okay, hang on, we might not be able to do this. And then they don't give themselves the best chance of getting close. They just seem to implode. Whereas, like you say, when they're batting first, there's a clarity to the way they think, and they're a bit more not considered, but they just seem to be able to keep their heads for longer and then go hard at the end, like we saw today.
And it's also like Roy and Bairstow can just imprint themselves in the game from the very start,
which they do a lot. That's not rare.
Pretty much every time, or at least one of them does it pretty much.
Is it three century opening partnerships in this World Cup in a row or something like that?
All quick as well.
They don't mess around. They're laying platforms. I saw something the other day. It's basically they're laying platforms, but at the rate at which people pinch it. So it's kind of they're going out and they're going hard to like try and steal a march on the opposition, but they're then making 120. You're getting the advantages of both strategies, which is, you know, it's ridiculous how good they are at doing that.
In amongst all the excitement, I believe you had a gripe, Ben, and this was Mark Wood's run out of Kane Williamson, which was obviously a very big moment in the game, but you're not happy with that mode of dismissal? Is that what?
Contrary to the caricature that's often painted of me on this show, I do occasionally get quite grumpy about cricket. The dismissal whereby a batsman hits the ball back down the pitch and a bowler sticks their hand out in hope and just vaguely touches it and the ball continues on its path, hits the stumps and dismisses the non-striker. It's legitimate. It's fine. There's no issue with the spirit of cricket here. There's none of that. None of the Mancadi nonsense. Like, it's completely legitimate and bowlers should be allowed to do it. But it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be in the rules. It's not fair to anyone.
Because there's not enough skill involved.
Skill involved. All the batsmen.
Sometimes there's a bit of skill involved.
I don't.
Some of the bowlers play for it and manage to get into a kind of awkward position to deflect the ball.
I think you can play for it, but I don't think any bowler can say that they have practiced the skill of deflecting a ricocheting the ball back onto the stumps. I think it's instinctive.
Perhaps even more skill.
It's fine. I get it. I do understand that it's impressive and bowlers should be praised if they do it well. But I just find it fundamentally, it's more of like a gut thing. It just doesn't feel fair to anyone. It's not rewarding anything good. In some ways, obviously, people are saying, oh, well, the batsman's out of his ground. But like, batsmen are allowed to be out of their ground to steal a run. But to then punish a batsman so heavily by being dismissed just feels so just over the top in terms of today's game suffered. And Kane Williamson didn't really make a mistake. All he did was be a tiny fraction out of his crease. And then England didn't do anything right other than Mark would stick his finger out and get a tiny touch on it, and then it goes into the stumps. I'm saying this in knowledge that I'm going to get absolutely massacred for it.
That's Ben's view. If you care this much about this modus dismissal,
no one does.
Twitter. Hashtag ask wisdom. Or you can just tell Ben that he's being boring and you don't care. That's
please
not so
don't
fine.
At me, please. I've had it already. I only posted it on Twitter an hour ago, and I've had it all afternoon.
Okay, what are we going to talk about next? Okay, the semi-final, seeing as England are there. England finished third, we know that, which means they will play the team who finished second, which is currently India, and will continue to be India unless Australia loses to South Africa.
And India win the last game.
And India win the last game, of course. Who would you prefer to play if you were England?
It's hard. I would still prefer to play Australia, because Australia are worse than India. But it's remarkable that it takes a bit of thought. At the start of the tournament, if you said, who do you want to play in the semi-final, India or Australia?
Well, wouldn't have taken any thought, would it?
Yeah, you'd have been like, oh yeah, obviously the team that can't win or the team that
well,
only
you'd have
win.
Said, well, Australia aren't even going to get to the semi-finals.
Yeah, whilst jumping on my laptop. I think that Australia's recovery has been ridiculous, and they're clearly a much better side now. They've got the balance right, everyone knows their role, they're clearly a rising side, and I would not be surprised one bit if England lost to them in the semi-final, if they played them. I wouldn't be surprised at this point if Australia won the whole thing. They're a team on the march. But England would rather play them in the semi-final, not at Lord's, because they've already played them at Lord's and Australia
didn't
won.
Go well. Yeah.
They've played India at Edgbaston and they won. And I think at this point, England, they're almost up to a speed now where they've had two must-win games and they've won both of them. I feel like keeping it at that level of intensity where you feel like you're playing the best is as good a chance of England kind of staying focused and getting the best out of their performance. Because I think if they face Australia, I can just see it as like, okay, so we've got to get through this and then we've got to beat India in the final. Whereas actually, if they just face India in the semi-final, they might lose, that's fine, but it's almost like that's the big challenge, and then you can kind of recover, do your research, go back again. I don't know. At this point, it's too emotional a decision. Like, I don't want to play either of them. I just want England to almost disappear out of the tournament, not go out, but just kind of not be in it anymore. It's too much.
Well, I definitely feel like it will be India. I think Australia will be desperate to win that last game because they'll want to play New Zealand, who are really sort of struggling in these later stages of the group stage. Also, that means they get two extra days rest because the Old Trafford semi-final is on the Tuesday, Edgbaston is on the Thursday. For what it's worth, I would rather play India in the semis. I think there's because I want to get England to the final, so I think the easier game at this stage is India,
which is bizarre,
and I think it's probably more of a kind of an emotional thing than a statistical thing that I'm thinking that. There's a thing about Australia, particularly given what happened at Lord's, particularly given the fact they were written off at the start of the tournament, and I think there are chinks in India. These have been discussed on the show over the last couple of days that England can really exploit again, having already exploited Edgbaston only a few days ago. And I think that India's side is suddenly not very settled as well, whereas England know the 11 they'll pick. I think they'll stick with the 11 that's won them the last two games.
Yeah, unless they rock up
until the end of this tournament.
Unless they rock up and the pitch is clearly going to spin, in which case they might bring Mo back in for someone. But yeah,
it's a very tricky call to make, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really
might,
hard.
You might still, even if you think it's going to spin a bit, you could still convince yourself that it's either Rashid or possibly Moen comes in instead of Rashid. I wouldn't go that way, but that is an
option.
And then you've got Joe Root.
I think the issue at this point, obviously, Root is bowling fine. fine and he's doing a really good job, but Rashid isn't bowling well, and so that is an extra element into the debate of, it's not that you can't really rely on Rashid to bowl 10 flawless overs if it's a really spinning wicket. You might need to mix and match them with another spinner. I do still think that India are a much better team than Australia, but they're a similar strategic side to Australia. They've got a similar setup. They want to get through the first 10 unbeaten, then they want to start to accelerate in the middle and then go really hard at the end with either Hardik or Maxwell. And then with the bowling line, they've both bizarrely, given you know the relative histories of those two countries, they've both got very comparatively skillful seam attacks who can hurt you all the way through, and Stark and Bumrah coming back throughout the innings to kind of bowl these little two over three over spells. That's a real concern, whoever they're playing. I've got a really uncomfortable feeling that that's going to be the final, is those two teams, India and Australia.
Oh come on, Ben, not today.
The optimism is kind of drained out of me today. I wouldn't mind that, because that would be an interesting game, because they've played a lot over the last 4 years, and actually they've played each other at different levels in terms of their trajectories. India have been really good and Australia have been awful, yeah. And actually Australia are still the world champions, bizarrely. And it would be quite a nice bookend to this cycle in a way if it was India-Australia. It'd be the perfect bookend if it was India-England. But I don't know, I'm kind of reconciling myself to the idea that actually England might not progress, and there's still a kind of poetry to that particular ending to the tournament.
Okay, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Listener, you can't see, I'm actually in tears.
So before I speak to Andrew Alderson, a final question for you, Ben, as much for my own benefit as our listeners, to be honest. So what do Pakistan need to do to leapfrog New Zealand? And is it worth talking about? Is it actually feasible?
Those are two different questions. It's definitely not worth talking about. But basically, they need to bat first and make a billion runs. And then
Come on, give me a figure, not a billion.
I'm pretty sure it's about 600. I think they need to win by something like 450 runs. Right. So they need to break the world record and then bowl Bangladesh out for about 150. But if they Pakistan bowl first, then they're out.
Yeah.
Which is why the toss is going to be hilarious. Because the whole Pakistan teaming about, they're like, it's a penalty shootout. They're all going to be crowding around, slow motion on the coin rising into the air. It's going to be really intense.
Ahead of a match that doesn't actually matter because they can't win by 450 runs anyway.
Exactly. So it's a proper stay of execution if they get to bat first. But, you know, they would still literally be in the competition.
Sure. Okay, well, basically, we know our semi-finalists then. That is England covered for the time being. Now let's turn our attention to New Zealand, who are really kind of stumbling towards the semi-finals. I caught up with Andrew Alderson of the New Zealand Herald after the Black Caps' defeat to England. Hi, Andrew. So after six matches unbeaten, that's now three defeats on the bounce for New Zealand. They're all but through, but this is a concerning development in the lead-up to the semi-finals, isn't it?
Oh, look, Joe, it sure is. It's hard to regain momentum from here for New Zealand, although I would say on the flip side of that, if the New Zealand team were able to channel particularly with the bat, all in sync, I think that they could be a formidable force still at this World Cup, potentially. I mean, I know there's some mathematical calculations to go, but a semi-final looks all but imminent at Manchester against Australia or India. So I think that if the batting could match the success generally over the course of the tournament they've had with the bowling in terms of being able to drag teams back, even after the 123 that Bairstow and Roy posted today, and I guess from 194 for one, they dragged them back with, I think they took four wickets for 54 between overs 31 and 42, and that was able to pair England back, and if they can do that and combine it with the bat and bring Lockie Ferguson back into proceedings, there is a chance.
Having started so well in this tournament, do you think they've started playing worse, or have they just been playing better sides?
I think it's better sides in a way. They had, in many ways, I think, Joe, the ideal draw in that they were playing a lot of the weaker sides early on, and they made capital while they could in those games. And I think if you look at those run rates now, just looking back at the tournament, the fact that New Zealand were able to, I guess, rustle up those runs really quickly against Sri Lanka in that first game at Cardiff. They got to 137 in a hurry. And if you compare it to Pakistan out for 105 against the West Indies, that's come back to haunt them. So that's where the run rate system can work in your favour, and it certainly has done for New Zealand.
Pakistan fans might argue that New Zealand have been a little bit lucky to get to this point. They got that point for the washout versus India, which is looking quite a handy point at this stage.
Oh, I think it's a good argument. It's probably, even you look back on it, a point gained rather than a point lost for New Zealand. I think that's fair. And it's going to be interesting, especially if they do come up against India in a semi-final. On that day at Trent Bridge, it was sort of, it was raining, obviously, to wash it out. I mean, maybe New Zealand could have made the most of those conditions, but it's going to be a big ask against the Indian side, as it would be against an Australian side from what we saw at Lord's a few days ago, just how comprehensively New Zealand were beaten in the end. So there's lots to work on, but it's particularly with the batting and particularly up top. I just think that Martin Guptill has to fire if New Zealand is to go any further in this tournament, and also potentially Henry Nicholls, and Kane Williamson left less vulnerable coming in at perhaps some stage outside or beyond the ninth over. I think he's been, apart from that opening match, he's been at every match he's been in at the ninth over or earlier.
Yeah, as you say, the batting has been the weakness, but I thought there were signs today without Lachie Ferguson there that the bowling looked a little flat at stages. I felt a bit sorry for Tim Southee today, been a brilliant performer for New Zealand for so long, not featured up till this point in the tournament, initially through injury. Then he comes in for a big match against the most destructive opening pair in world cricket, and he didn't go so well. It was a big ask for him today, wasn't it?
It was, and he looked to be fading there, Tim. I mean, because he hasn't probably got the pace that he once had. But when you've got Roy and Bairstow in such destructive form, hard to come in and bowl against that. And that's where, as you mentioned, I mean, Ferguson has made a massive difference for New Zealand, being able to get the ball to rocket through at considerable pace up around 150, and just that makes all the difference at times. And I think that it's a fair point. New Zealand bowling did struggle, but it was just that period where they were able to keep their composure, I suppose, between overs 31 and 42 after taking a couple of wickets, and just to at least peg England back slightly, because effectively the score was coming up to that wall of 400 in a way. It was escalating at a great rate,
yeah.
And I think to be able to pair it back to 305 over the course of that innings was quite good, really, given where circumstances could have gone from a New Zealand perspective.
Returning to the batting, I have a controversial suggestion for you. You can call me an idiot if you like. Given New Zealand's openers aren't getting any runs and are frequently getting out on the first over, what about Kane Williamson opening the batting? Because he's done it in T20 cricket quite successfully. It would stop this other opposition having this initiative of an early wicket every single game, it seems like. Is there any merit in that at all? I suggest it's unlikely, but would you see any merit in that?
I think it's extremely unlikely in how they play the game. I think they want to back the people that they've got, but it's certainly a worthy suggestion given the current scenario. I'll tell you what, the other suggestion that has been made, which I think also holds merit to a large degree, is that Tom Latham is a player who opens in test matches and has a terrifically successful record at that. I know it's not the same tempo, but if it was to offer Martin Guptill some more stability, Guptill would have to be the aggressor, of course, but he effectively is with Nicholls at the crease as well. Henry Nicholls had tremendous success in the test game in the middle order. So perhaps that might have some logic to it, although I dare say they're probably not going to try that now with, now that they're going to be in playoff cricket, presumably, if a miracle isn't to happen between Pakistan and Bangladesh at Lord's in a couple of days.
And then just last up for you, Andrew, assuming New Zealand do go through, which I think we all are, they'll face Australia or India at Old Trafford next Tuesday. Who do you think they'd prefer to play?
Oh, they'll certainly say either, but from my perspective, looking at them, I think that they'd probably prefer to play India, in that they haven't played India yet, and that potentially would provide an element of surprise, if you like. I mean, having seen what Australia did to them at Lord's, and you look at what Mitchell Stark delivers. I mean, I know Jasprit Bumrah is a terrific bowler opening up as well, but I think Stark has a particular aura with New Zealand with what he's been able to do. I think when you look back to the World Cup final as well, and I think that that would be the team they'd probably prefer, because if they could get some early wickets, I think they'd probably fancy their chances more, given it'd be... fresh opposition, if you like, someone they haven't played previously, and that's probably the only logic I can come up with, because they're two pretty formidable sides when you're in New Zealand's position at the moment, having lost three on the bounce.
They certainly are, Andrew. Brilliant to get your thoughts as ever. Thanks so much for joining us, and all being well, we'll look forward to perhaps hearing from you in the semi-finals.
Indeed, Joe. Thanks very much for having me on.
Cheers, Andrew. That's the end of the show on what has proved to be a very big day for England indeed. Thanks to Ben and Andrew for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow, and Yaz Rana and I will be joined by Wisden Almanac editor Lawrence Booth. Do not worry, we won't dedicate a whole show or even much of it at all to the dead rubber between West Indies and Afghanistan. We'll be focusing on the women's Ashes, looking ahead to the World Cup semi-finals, of course, and chatting about some good old county cricket. This has been the Wisden Cricket Daily Podcast in partnership with Travel Bag, creating holidays packed full of memories since 1979. Thanks for joining us, and don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or any of the other usual platforms.